Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome to An Adventure in History. I'm Alana Quila, here tonight with Mac Burns, Executive Director of the Clatsop County Historical Society. We are just rolling through summer.
We are.
A couple more weeks till school starts.
See, the minute you say rolling, because I'm like love TV. Yeah. I've always loved TV.
Yes.
I immediately rolling, keep them doggies rolling, rawhide.
I just think you like to sing on the radio.
I probably do, but I also never actually saw Rawhide.
Oh, yeah.
I just know the theme song from
That's
it.
That's true, me either.
There's a lot of TV shows, like I know the theme song or I know things about it, but
sure.
I never watch them. But anytime rolling, I hear.
There you go.
That instantly goes in. I think Rawhide, that was Clint Eastwood was in that as a kid. As a young
oh,
guy,
interesting.
Like a 20-year-old.
As a kid, right?
Yeah.
Because he's always been really old.
He has been really old for a long time.
He's one of those people.
So I'm sorry, I cut you off though because you distracted me by saying rolling.
I did, yeah. Well, I was thinking you were going to say, you know, we're going to roll into some, you know, action-filled story tonight about movies.
A
movie.
You're giving the teaser ahead of time.
Okay.
Shall we jump? Because I thought you were about to say something about like getting ready for school.
Yes, it is coming to an end, but you know, that's good.
And do you do like a big like, oh, let's go buy clothes for the kids for school? Or is it just, hey, we already have clothes? Who
yes.
cares?
Yeah, we don't. We haven't yet.
As a child, we always, end of the summer, drove from New York to Delaware because they didn't have sales tax to visit my grandparents. And it was always about buying clothes for school and school supplies.
Sure. You know, we don't have to buy school supplies for students at Astor, which is really nice.
Nice.
Isn't that? They've had a grant that they have gotten for several years. And so, yeah, don't have to buy anything. And so
the nice
thing, too, is the teachers, I believe, get what they want.
Oh, they get to choose.
Because they go in, you know, they all have the same supplies, of course, too. But
I always worry about like, hey, we bought you pencils and so did every other student. So now, oh, thanks. I have 500 pencils, but no paper or something like that.
No.
Wow. Okay. So let's see, since I've totally derailed the show by my distraction.
This day in history.
We'll get to this day in history then. August 22nd. These are things that happen tomorrow.
Yep. We're ready.
1762. Anne Franklin, the first female U.S. newspaper editor.
Ooh, I love that.
I put that one in just for you.
Yes. Does it say the paper?
She's in Newport, Rhode Island, and the newspaper is The Mercury.
Great. Good for her.
I kind of like that name for a newspaper.
Yes.
Rather than just like Daily News.
Right.
Or the local post. I don't know why I like Mercury.
The Mercury.
It sounds
out of this world.
It sounds very nice. Exactly. It sounds like 1930s.
It does.
But 1762.
Good for her.
All right. 1775. King George III proclaims the colonies to be an open rebellion. Mm. How dare you?
Yep. Didn't like that.
And I think we always kind of forget. We were rebels. We were traitors.
From the get-go.
Exactly. 1780, HMS Resolution without Captain James Cook returns to England.
Oh.
Because he was in this area.
Right.
That's why we like that. And then, of course, he had a misfortune in Hawaii.
Yes. For him.
For him. Which I kind of feel badly, and I'm adding to it by not even writing down the name of the guy that becomes the captain and takes it the rest of the way.
Oh, interesting.
We remember Cook, but he doesn't get all the way.
Right.
So why don't we remember the other guy?
Well, because he was so colorful, right?
That could be.
Yeah.
1848, the U.S. annexes New Mexico.
Oh.
I like New Mexico. But I love that, we just annexed it.
I know.
Not like we took it.
I know. That's. I was going to say an interesting word to use.
Yes. But I'm glad we took it because I like New Mexico. My parents lived there for 35 years.
Yeah.
I like visiting there. 1865. Oh, I forgot I wasn't going to give you. I was going to make you guess. I wasn't going to give you the date. Darn. William Shepard is issued the first U.S. patent for liquid soap.
Oh.
1865. I never would have guessed that.
Never.
I would have put like 1920.
I don't even know that I would have gone back that far.
And I really would have thought more like 1940s.
Yeah, or 50s even, you know.
Liquid soap.
Good for him.
In 1865.
Thank you. Yeah. I like liquid soap.
Where are they traveling that they need liquid soap?
That's true. Right.
I would think a bar would be better. Like if for me you're to get traveling. On a train or on a horse or something.
Yes.
All right. 1902, U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt becomes the first U.S. president to ride in a car.
Ooh.
Okay. And I really should put like on our website or something, you know, we've had the best Teddy Roosevelt impersonator twice. We've brought him mm-hmm. with the through the Samuel S. Johnson Foundation support and one time from Wells Fargo support and always from the Oregon Historical Society support. We've brought this reenactor. He's world class. He's the best guy. He is Teddy Roosevelt. It's amazing. But the first time we had him, we put him in the Oregon Film Museum, and I made him do some specials on film, including he got in the car, and he says, "Here I am driving across Oregon in my automobile." And it just looks like Teddy Roosevelt, except for the modern background and the fact that it's a pickup truck that he's driving. But I should put that out there again because it's pretty funny.
And he probably wasn't driving himself, right? I mean,
probably not. Well, no, actually, I bet Teddy was driving himself.
Oh, you think? Okay.
Oh, come on. He's adventuresome, so.
Yeah.
He probably, if they tried to make him sit in the back or something, he's probably like, let me try this.
Yeah, looks fun.
All right. 1906, the first Victor Victrolia is manufactured.
Yeah.
Records. 1966, the Beatles arrive in New York.
Oh, how fun.
Are you a Beatles fan?
No.
See, I'm not particularly either.
Yeah.
I mean, they're good.
But they definitely, when we talk about impact,
yes.
They definitely had an impact on culture and music for 100%, sure.
100%. And I respect the output and I respect that people went nuts for them.
Yeah.
I just, it's good. It's good music. Yeah.
They were very fortunate and lucky.
1986, Stand By Me, an Oregon film, is released.
1986. I didn't realize it was so old.
Now you're making me feel old. 1986. I think it is one of the best Oregon films.
It's really good. It is.
I would have to put it. I've never actually ranked all the Oregon films.
Ooh, we should do that one day.
I would definitely put it in the top 10.
Have you read The Body?
I have.
And
congratulations on knowing the real title of the...
Of course I do.
Because it was in one of the Stephen King short story books.
Short stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I loved the book, the book version. Mm-hmm. And I love the movie. I think that they complement each other well and respect each other. Sometimes I don't agree with the way that his books are filmed.
But, right.
But this one was all right.
I'll have to go back and read that because.
And Cottage Grove, where it was filmed, part of it was filmed. They do a big Stand By Me festival.
Oh, still.
They kind of get it. We get the Goonies here. They understand Stand By Me. But our history highlight of the day, as much as that was almost going to be, and the Beatles was almost going to be, I had to agree, though, in 1864, the International Red Cross is formed.
That's a great one.
Got to respect the Red Cross.
Yep.
Who doesn't love the Red Cross?
Correct. So. That's good. The one thing you missed, 1969, Hurricane Camille hits the U.S. Gulf Coast, killing 256 and causing $1.42 billion in damages. Mm. So it was 1969, and at the time it was the second worst hurricane ever to hit the United States.
Wow.
And 256, that was a pretty huge, because it hit Cuba, mm-hmm. and it was very devastating, of course, and killed people, went up through Florida and really demolished the whole panhandle. And I put this one on because I did live in Panama City, and every hurricane season, we always brought up Hurricane Camille because it was 1970. So it was something that people there still remembered. It was still very traumatic. And to date, when I lived there, had been the worst ever. Hurricane Michael, however, came and this was in 2018, and it hit Panama City head on, and it was a Hurricane 4. And they later determined it to be a Hurricane 5, and it devastated this community. Just took out entire neighborhoods, entire everything. Tyndall Air Force Base, huge Air Force Base, which is where NORAD is located. We've talked about that. It, too, was completely destroyed. The base existed, but all of the housing that everyone lived in, all of it was gone.
Wow.
Fort Walton Beach, so all of these areas. I just thought it was kind of... just stunning. So from 1970 to 2018, there were lots of hurricanes, and I was there during some really bad ones.
Well, that's what I'm going to ask. Did you live through any?
I did live through one. I lived through Hurricane Ivan, which was terrible, and it was so terrible, and several people were killed during Hurricane Ivan when there was about, I think it was 13 tornadoes came through. Mm. It was terrifying. And I created a resume tape, I want to say within 2 weeks of that hurricane and tornadoes, because I was there during the tornadoes, came through, and I had a job, and I moved across the country, sight unseen, to Reno, Nevada within 3 months.
Just to get out of there?
I was done. Wow. I mean, it was the tornado, too. It was just, it was terrifying. Because in Florida, there's no basements. You know, people talk about, well, you go to a safe space. Well, there's no safe space. Mm-hmm. I mean, if a tornado hits your house head on, you know, I, again, was able as a journalist to see that aftermath, and it was terrible and terrifying. But that Hurricane Michael, because we went back, now I really am digressing, we went back to Panama City just a couple of years ago, and the mall is still gone. The mall.
Well, the mall was dying anyway.
There was nothing there, Mac.
Wow.
Nothing. A mall. I mean, a full-size, you know, like we're talking Lloyd Center, one floor. So it just, you know, I mean, hurricanes just are powerful. Erased. I think it just is something to remember that when we talk about, because we don't have hurricanes here, we have hurricane force winds sometime, but not hurricanes. It is very different when you think about entire communities.
But we get them broken up because of hills and things like that that Florida doesn't have. So
correct. And winds, right, is not the same as a hurricane, because a hurricane is sustained and over a period of time.
My wife lived in Florida through Andrew.
Oh,
so she's
got
some good stories.
Yes. Yep. So. Another one that. Okay. So let's.
All right.
Let's move over.
So we mentioned that Stand By Me was released on tomorrow, August 22nd, in 1986. So we thought we'd share some behind the scenes stories.
Because
this is one of my favorite. I would put it in my top like 50 all time films of everything.
When the cast was
Oregon.
So good. Yes.
Yeah.
It's good.
So shall we just get right into it?
Let's do it.
So for those that don't know, Stand By Me, it's a story about four preteen boys from Oregon who set off on an overnight adventure to find a body. Hence the original Stephen King name of the book or the story, The Body.
The Body.
There are no girls, first kisses or huge revelations, or big name movie stars in the film. Yet from these stories about the making of Stand By Me, it's easy to see why the film is often regarded among the best coming of age movies in cinema history. If not for a few lucky breaks, however, the movie perhaps would not exist at all. And I apologize, I can't remember where I found this. Usually I like write down the name, like, hey, this is an article, such and such. So I'm not sure where I found this. It was in my files, because anything about Oregon films, I just grab
it's
and
there.
Put into a big file called
it's
Oregon Films.
It's in Mac's office.
Yeah. So Stand By Me is an adaptation of Stephen King's 1982 novella, The Body, directed by Rob Reiner. He was coming off a modest box office success of his mockumentary, This Is Spinal Tap, which makes me laugh.
It's so funny.
And seemed like an unlikely choice to lead the project. However, the former TV actor was able to hone the raw talent of the four leads, all kid actors, Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Corey Feldman from The Goonies, and Jerry O'Connell, making them appear as if they'd been best friends their whole lives.
What great casting, too, right?
It is.
I mean, they just didn't know yet.
Yeah. The production, like that of many great films, is filled with obstacles. No studio in Hollywood even wanted to make the film. And, of course, plenty of hijinks, I love that word, and hard lessons ensued on the set. Not only did the characters grow up on their adventure to find Ray Brower, the body, but the actors who played them grew up as well.
Okay. The film's four leads varied in their acting experience. Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, and Corey Feldman each had at least 5 years in front of the camera. Jerry O'Connell, however, the youngest of the group at 11 years old, had mostly done commercials. To create the illusion of a long-standing camaraderie among the actors, Rob Reiner and the four boys went up to the filming locales in Oregon for 2 weeks of rehearsal. Reiner called this period acting classes. He gathered the boys to play games based on Viola Spolin's book, Improvisation for Theater. Reiner said the games, quote, they develop trust among people and her book is the Bible, end quote. The exercises were effective as the movie sells the boys' friendship with ease. Reiner's rehearsal time helped to create magical chemistry that usually only comes with lifelong friendships. O'Connell added, Rob was so great with kids. He was like the fifth boy in Stand By Me. For the first 2 weeks, we didn't say a line. We didn't rehearse. He locked us in a room and we played games and hung out. And we became friends.
Wow.
How
Rob
fun.
Reiner.
Yeah.
The four boys became close friends during production. Before filming, Rob Reiner did everything he could to build a foundation of brotherhood among the four leads. His efforts were not in vain. During a 1986 interview, River Phoenix said of the director, "Rob kept us together. The first 3 weeks were the most fun. We took all the hotel pool chairs and threw them into the pool." You wacky hijinks kids.
Yeah.
"We soaked Corey Feldman's clothes in beer and they dried and he smelled like a wino. Will Wheaton is a video whiz. He fixed the machines in the hotel so we got free games. I took the blame. I said, 'You do it for me and I'll take the blame.' The boys grew so close. They even fought like old friends. Just like in the movie, we had big fights, stupid stuff, boys and their egos, like who got to walk down the railroad tracks first. Always toward the end of the movie, you get sick of each other," Phoenix added. Will Wheaton agreed, "When you saw the four of us being comrades, that was real life, not acting."
Oh. Perhaps the most heart-pounding scene in the movie is the one on that train trestle. When the boys are partway down the tracks, the train comes racing towards them. Since there is no safe place to jump off the track, the only way to survive is to outrun the locomotive. Of course, the four young actors were not in any real jeopardy. Rob Reiner used a special long lens to create the illusion of the train being incredibly close. But because the actors didn't fear for their lives, Reiner wasn't getting the reaction he wanted. To elicit the proper responses, he decided he had to scare them. "We had some guys. It was very hot, 90 degrees out, and the guys were pushing this dolly down the track to follow these boys running. They were supposed to be hysterical, just crying and panicking. We did it a bunch of times, and they were not getting worked up. Finally, I started screaming, 'These guys, the crew, are exhausted because you guys keep messing up, and if you're not worried that the train is going to kill you, I will.' He said they started crying, we started rolling, and then they ran off the track and gave me a big hug and said, 'We did it. We did it, Rob.'" Rob Reiner's, he coached River Phoenix through that movie's most emotional scene. One of the reasons Rob Reiner was a great director was his history as an actor. In the emotional milk money scene, in which River Phoenix character, Chris, tells Gordy about the ultimate betrayal of one of his teachers, Reiner was not getting the response he wanted. The director took the young actor aside and gave him some sage advice. "You don't have to tell me what it is, but think about a time that an adult, somebody important to you, let you down, and you felt like they weren't there for you." Phoenix was able to use the advice and turn the scene into one of the film's emotional centerpieces. Richard Dreyfuss, who provided the voice of the older Gordy in Stand By Me, could see the raw talent in Phoenix. He was, without question, the best of that group of actors that came up at that time. Movie stardom is not just acting talent. It's not just your ability to move an audience. It's a combination of things, and he had a lot of it. He passed so young that it was a real shame.
Yeah, just like the character in the book, that he was my best friend and he gets killed.
Mm-hmm.
Kiefer Sutherland stayed in character throughout the shoot. Kiefer Sutherland played Ace Merrill, the villain and leader of the bad boy pack that antagonizes the film's protagonists along their journey. Sutherland was in his 20s at the time, and even though Rob Reiner described Sutherland as a soft-spoken, sweet, and intelligent young man, Sutherland didn't act as such, even when the cameras stopped rolling. Instead, he opted to go method and stay in character. "I wasn't scared of anyone on the set, except Kiefer," Jerry O'Connell, who played Vern, admitted. "He really made himself very menacing to us."
Now, see, that makes me think, are you sure that that wasn't really him?
Yeah. I like Kiefer Sutherland, though. But so hopefully it was just method acting.
He sort of does seem to play a lot of the similar characters. Stunt women were used for the train chase scene. Martin Hansen was in charge of running the train engine during the train trestle crossing scene. It took a solid week to shoot just the one scene of us chasing the kids off the trestle. "We probably ran the train over the trestle 36 times during that week," Hansen said. "Director Rob Reiner kept asking us to go faster, but there comes a point with the increased speed where the train starts to lean into the curve at the end of the trestle, and that's not a good feeling." Reiner was extra careful with the four leads, who brought in stunt doubles to ensure their safety. The stunt doubles needed to resemble the size of preteen boys, so four women were hired. The young actors couldn't do the stunt work on the trestle when the train was on the trestle, so they actually had four short women. They were dressed like the boys and had their hair cropped short.
I want to go back and I need to watch this now.
I know.
In slow motion or
see
something.
See these scenes.
The pond was man-made and disgusting.
Ugh. The scene still gives me, I think about it every time I'm in a body of water where you can't see the bottom.
And see, not to be sexist, but I think men think about that scene more than women do.
Probably. You have to watch the movie, folks.
Yeah. In one part of the film, the boys have to wade through a murky swamp. This was a body of water made by the production team. The crew dug out an area of the forest and filled it with water in June, though the scene wasn't filmed until August. By then, the swamp was rife with disgusting bacteria and plant life. Kent Luttrell, who played Ray Brower, also served as a stand-in during production. He described the swamp scene. The leech scene was pretty interesting because they made a fake swamp and it was just really difficult and fairly nasty. And you were just wet all the time. That stands out in my head because of the kids running around with leeches all over them. I remember seeing the leeches. They were just little rubber molds they made. Will Wheaton, whose character was the unfortunate victim of an embarrassing leech incident, that's one way to word it, said of the swamp, "It was cold and really gross, and it skeeved me out. There were water slides in the mall, and the day that we shot the leeches, we went to go play on the water slides like we always did, and they wouldn't let us in because they thought we had open lesions on our skin."
From where the, probably where the leeches were stuck. Jerry O'Connell accidentally ate pot cookies. During a 2012 interview on Jimmy Kimmel Live, Kiefer Sutherland told the story of how a young Jerry O'Connell inadvertently consumed pot cookies during the production of the movie. Sutherland alleged O'Connell tied his babysitter to a banister because he wanted to go to the local fair. However, the fair turned out to be a hippie fair, rife with a variety of substances. Unbeknownst to O'Connell, the cookies he'd purchased contained weed.
Unbeknown.
Yeah. Welcome to Oregon.
Yeah. No studio wanted to make the movie. Stand By Me was different than most coming-of-age stories. For example, it doesn't feature a love interest. And when a script is different, Hollywood usually won't make it. Bruce Evans, a producer and co-writer on the film, described why nearly every studio passed on Stand By Me. Every studio in town had turned us down. The consensus was that no one would be interested in a story about four 12-year-old boys on a railroad track. It was dark. There was not a girl in it. No one knew how to sell it. Of course, what attracted us to it was that it was a coming-of-age story without girls or buying condoms or first kisses or all of that. It was about kids becoming aware of their own mortality.
Like another popular movie that was filmed here that also did very, very well.
but that had girls in it and kissing.
Oh, that's true. I guess. Yes. Okay. Norman Lear personally financed the film. Just a few days before the start of production, Stand By Me's studio Embassy, which was co-owned by Norman Lear, was sold to Columbia. For many of the same reasons why no studio initially wanted to make the picture, the crew was told to shut down the production. Thankfully, Lear, who produced the groundbreaking sitcom All in the Family, which co-starred Rob Reiner, had faith in Stand By Me. He said, "I liked the script, I liked Rob, I liked the boys." Lear used $7.5 million of his own money to finance the movie.
Wow, how nice, how generous.
Yeah.
The pie-eating scene almost didn't make it into the movie. That would have been tragic.
Yeah.
Perhaps the most famous scene in Stand By Me is Gordy's fireside story about the sweet revenge of, I'm not going to name the name. No, I could say that.
Lard Butt. Yeah.
That's not the real name. A picked on boy who competes in a pie eating contest. Initially, Rob Reiner didn't know how to handle the scene because he couldn't quite envision adult Gordy as a writer. I wrestled with including the pie eating scene, not because it was too graphic, but because we'd established that Gordy is going to turn into a great writer someday. Would he really tell a story about vomiting? It's like a story about poop. So I went back and forth, but I made peace and I said, okay. I think, of course, a kid who becomes a great writer would tell a story like
yes,
that.
Yes, and tell it well, right?
Yeah.
The pie-eating scene needed to be way over the top. Once Rob Reiner decided to leave in the pie-eating scene, he realized it had to be totally over the top. The director went with a mixture of blueberry pie filling and cottage cheese for the vomit. Nasty. And ensured that several cameras were rolling to avoid the mess of multiple reshoots. Getting the scene just right took time. However, Andy Lindberg, who played the revenge-seeking boy, described the process. The first time the crew tried the throwing up scene, they had to use a power washer, but that didn't work. The stream was too fine. Finally, after experimenting, they got four or five guys to press down on a giant plunger on top of a cylinder, which pushed all 5 gallons of pie, filling up a vacuum hose through my shirt collar and out from the tubes taped to the side of my face. I remember talking to the extras, and they were joking about how sticky and covered in goo I was. But then the tables got turned the next day. they had to all vomit on each other. So the expression of satisfaction I make on the film was a bit truthful.
River Phoenix's looks may have sold the movie. After the film wrapped, the possibility of it still not being released to theaters persisted. Because of Embassy's sale to Columbia, the production lacked a distributor. Rob Reiner stated that despite bringing the finished movie to every studio, they still couldn't find distribution. The producers didn't think that Columbia was interested in the project because they had previously passed. However, the company had taken on a new management, and the new studio head loved the film. In the end, River Phoenix's matinee idol looks possibly sealed the deal. Producer Bruce Evans said what happened was Columbia's production head named Guy McQuillan wasn't feeling good, so he had the movie shown at his house. He brought all the marketing people and the executives, but the crucial members of the audience were his two daughters. About halfway through, they were in love with River Phoenix.
Oh, I like that. Rob Reiner acted out each character. Some directors are more involved in their actors' performances than others. During the production of Stand By Me, Rob Reiner was about as involved as he could be. River Phoenix described Reiner's process, saying Rob would act out each character. Reiner himself explained, "I would stand behind the camera and act nearly every scene out for them so they could hear what the part should sound like. That's part of the benefits of being an actor myself. I don't want the kids to be acting." I had some trouble with Corey Feldman, who would say, "You're not letting me act." And I would say, "This has to be real." Producer Norman Lear explains how Reiner's history as an actor dictated his methods. Rob's emotions are right at the surface. He has the easiest access to his deepest feelings of anyone I know, so he can articulate what he wants to the actor. The part of him that's almost 40 and the part that will be 60 are as accessible as the part that was 12.
I like that. The filmmakers decided Gordy, not Chris, should be the story's main focus. When Rob Reiner was first handed the script to Stand By Me, he admitted he initially couldn't figure out how to adapt the story to the big screen. Reiner and producer Andrew Scheinman finally had a massive breakthrough once they determined that Gordy, not Chris, needed to be the central character of the tale. I do need to go back and read
the
book.
So this is,
in the initial version, Gordy was just one of the four characters. Like, he was an observer. He wasn't the main focus of it. Then I was like, this is about a kid who has insecure feelings about himself. He's driven to go see this body because he never cried at his brother's funeral service. And his father always paid more attention to his older brother, who had passed. The producers were initially hesitant to shift the focus of the main narrative. However, they eventually all agreed that Reiner's vision was the best approach. Producer Bruce Evans said, "We resisted it at first, but then we saw where he was going. Rob does that stuff very well. Maybe it's part of his personality, growing up with a father who was very famous."
Interesting. Yeah, so now I am curious.
Yeah, we got to go back and reread this. I hope it's still on my shelf somewhere.
So I wonder what Stephen King thought of it. Obviously, he allowed for the adaptation to occur in the first place.
That's right.
They bought the rights to it.
And that's late enough that he really probably didn't have to have the money.
Right.
Early on, you know, selling.
But he is opinionated,
That's true. He does have opinions. So I believe, I've never actually been to the festival that they do in Brownsville, but they have a little walking tour. They used to have it. I don't think they have it anymore. A little penny in the intersection where Vern says, "Hey, look, a penny," and picks it up.
Oh, funny.
But I think they do a pie eating contest as part of their celebration.
Oh, but no throwing up, right?
No throwing up to my knowledge.
Yeah.
Although, you know, any kind of food eating contest, I feel like probably does lead to vomiting at some
point.
Right.
Well, you do a pie eating contest too. So.
But mine are tiny.
Right. Yes, they
it's
are.
It's just one.
Yeah.
It's speed. It's not how many can you eat. So maybe there it's...
Yeah,
it's just one in the speed as well. But I think they get like 5,000 people.
Oh, how fun. Well, we'll have to look that up. And we have a new book to add to my book list.
That's right. Well, to re-add it to your book list.
Re-add it. Well, I haven't read it, right?
You've never read it?
I've never read The Body.
I thought you had read
it. No, that's why I'd asked if you had.
Oh.
No, this is one of the ones where I actually saw the movie. And
I totally misunderstood since you knew the original title.
I know.
Wow, you do your research. Yep. All right. Well, go watch Stand By Me and read The Body and go make some history. And we'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.